The United Nations climate meeting in Glasgow, which starts on October 31st, is described as the most important since the Paris Agreement was adopted in 2015. We could see major policy announcements from the Biden administration or governments from around the world. But the summer we've just had, with its appalling wildfires and its record floods, provides ample evidence that the effects of climate change are already here, and they're catastrophic. And frankly, nothing that governments are likely to do this year will be enough to reverse those trends. Andreas Malm is a professor at Lund University in Sweden. He studies the relationship between climate change and capitalism, and he advocates for far more drastic action than we've seen so far. His recent book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline, is a bit more nuanced than the title suggests, but at its core, he really does want environmental activists to rethink their commitment to nonviolence and embrace tactics of sabotage. I spoke with Andreas Malm last week. Andreas, you've been a climate activist now for a long time, and in 2007, you were part of a Swedish group that started deflating the tires on SUVs. Tell me about that. What was the impulse, and how did it work?
Yeah, so what we did was we went through rich neighborhoods and picked out SUVs. This was in the early career of SUVs when they were still remarkable on streets before they had become completely ubiquitous. And it's very easy to deflate the tires of a car. You just unscrew the valve and you insert a little gravel or a piece of stone or something like that, and you screw the valve back on, and then the air will be out of the tire in a couple of hours. So this was not property destruction. It didn't damage anything. It created an inconvenience for the owners of SUVs.
What was the result of this action? Were there arrests? Did anybody do jail time?
There was eventually one arrest, but that was after thousands of SUVs had been deflated in this manner.
And did that cause consciousness about SUVs to change in Sweden? And did sales go down?
Sales went down quite sharply. And we took credit for that. I mean, I don't know if you could scientifically establish that our actions were the cause of that plunge in sales that happened during that year. You know, there have been, over the past decades, there have been those moments when climate has been on the top of the political agenda. And this was one of those moments. There was the fourth IPCC report that received the Nobel Peace Prize. There was the movie by Al Gore. There was the run-up to Copenhagen. And in this setting, our actions probably contributed to decreasing sales of SUVs.
Now, you've gone from deflating tires to writing a book now in 2021 called How to Blow Up a Pipeline. What was the moment that you realized that your next book would have to be about targeted sabotage, and why?
That moment was very much the summer of 2018, which was unprecedented in Northern Europe for the wildfires and the drought and the heat wave. And during that summer, I felt panic and desperation, as a lot of people did. This was the summer that led Greta Thunberg to start her later very famous school strike movement. And that sort of changed the picture, because in 2019, all the way up to the outbreak of the pandemic, the climate movement in the global north reached its zenith of mobilization, really its peak of popular force out on the streets. So the book became a product of the moment of 2019, but it's also a call for escalation, a call for the movement to diversify its tactics and move away from an exclusive focus on polite, gentle, and perfectly peaceful civil disobedience.
What actions are you recommending for the movement?
Well, I am recommending that the movement continues with mass action and civil disobedience, but also opens up for property destruction. So I'm not saying we should stop strikes or square occupations or demonstrations of the usual kind. I'm all in favor of that. But I do think we need to step up, because so little has changed and so many investments are still being poured into new fossil fuel projects. So I am in favor of destroying machines, property, not harming people. That's a very, very important distinction there. And I think property can be destroyed in all manner of ways, or it can be neutralized in a very gentle fashion, as when we deflated the SUVs, or in a more spectacular fashion, as in potentially blowing up a pipeline that's under construction. That's something that people have done.
So you are recommending blowing up a pipeline. You use the phrase intelligent sabotage. What does intelligent sabotage look like in this context?
Well, let me give you a very concrete example. Right now, Total, the largest single private company headquartered in France, is constructing what will be the world's longest heated oil pipeline in Uganda and Tanzania, and displacing in that process about 100,000 farmers, all for the sake of carrying even more oil to the world market to pour fuel on the global fire. If people in that region were to attack the construction equipment, blow up the pipeline before it's completed, I would be all in favor of that. I don't see how that property damage could be considered morally illegitimate, given what we know of the consequences of such a project.
Do you yourself plan to be involved in such actions?
Well, if I were planning things, I wouldn't tell you or anyone else. That's part of the whole idea of this kind of things. You don't say in advance what you're going to do if you plan to do something. But I'm personally, in principle, prepared to, of course, to be part of any kind of action of the sort that I advocate in the book. Anything else would be irresponsible.
Andreas, you argue that these are tactics that have worked in the past. One example that you point to in your book is when Nigerian activists, fighting the devastating effects of oil production in the country in the early 2000s, took real action. Tell me about that and how effective it was.
They blew up pipelines, they destroyed infrastructure, they went so far as to kidnap oil workers, something that I certainly wouldn't recommend. And they were successful at a particular moment when it seemed that the major oil companies like Shell and ExxonMobil were on the verge of quitting the area. Then repression kicked in, many activists were jailed, and obviously oil production is still ongoing in the Niger Delta. So you can say that that is a case of successful termination of oil production, certainly not. I bring that up as one case among many others that show that property damage is technically feasible. Another very recent example is these anonymous hackers who brought the Colonial Pipeline in the U.S., the largest pipeline in the U.S., to a complete standstill by hacking the computers. This was about a half year ago, I believe. And that pipeline didn't convey any gas for a week. But given the magnitude of the climate threat, the paradox here is that people have not engaged in this with reference to the climate crisis. How is it that the planet is on fire, almost literally, you know, wildfires moving from one country to the other? It's underwater with floods and storms like you saw in New York just the other week. And continuous production of new installations for fossil fuel extraction is totally normalized and it's happening all over the place. And people don't rise up when they know, at some level at least, they know that if these sources are not closed down, we will have more and more of the wildfires, we'll have more and more of the droughts, more and more heat waves, more and more floods, until we can live no longer.
And yet climate activist groups like 350.org and Extinction Rebellion have made clear that nonviolence is central to their approach. Do you think that's been a mistake or a tactical error?
Yeah, so I have nothing against the tactics employed by these groups. I have very often participated in them myself. What I have a problem with is when Extinction Rebellion and people from 350 and elsewhere say that these are the only things that our movement can ever allow itself to engage in. As in, what we are doing is as far as we will ever go. We'll never escalate beyond this. And I think that idea, this dogmatic commitment to nonviolence, is based on a faulty history writing or understanding of social struggles over history, because it's based on the idea that the only thing that has ever worked for social movements is to stay completely peaceful. And that just isn't the case. Most social movements that have struggled against overwhelming odds, against enemies that have been very powerful, have diversified and used a number of different tactics ranging into property destruction and confrontation with the police. You saw this during the uprising after the murder of George Floyd, where there was tremendous property destruction and conquering and burning down police stations in Minneapolis and things like that. That was an integral part of an uprising that brought more millions of people into the streets of the U.S. than any other in American history.
But Andreas, the overwhelming number of people in the demonstrations following the murder of George Floyd were nonviolent.
Peaceful. Of course.
And in fact, some scholars, some activists made the argument that in fact the small minority, the instances of violence or property destruction was a hindrance, was alienating in terms of public opinion. How do you argue with that?
Well, I think that is a faulty reading of what happened, because to my understanding, what really kicked off that uprising and took it to another scale were the events 3 days after the murder of Floyd, when the good people of Minneapolis stormed the police station in the 3rd Precinct where Derek Chauvin and his colleagues had been based. And as far as I can tell, that was a catalyst for the movement. And contrary to the ideas of strategic pacifism, it went hand in hand with an overwhelming majority of peaceful activities, just as you say. Of course, there was always a tension between militant groups and the peaceful majorities, as it usually is the case. But I don't think that anyone could seriously argue that the BLM movement in 2020 would have achieved more if there had been no confrontations, no windows smashed, no police stations or cars burnt. That's a fantasy scenario, in my view.
You use the analogy with the civil rights movement in the United States,
yeah.
the tension between the broader nonviolent movement of SNCC and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and
yeah.
Martin Luther King, and then on the other hand, other groups. So how do you analogize those things with the climate movement?
Yeah, so the idea from that case is that there was a so-called radical flank effect, that the existence of a radical flank of the civil rights movement and a sort of threat of a more militant wing, as in Malcolm X, the urban riots and things like that, actually worked to the strategic advantage of the civil rights mainstream, because it allowed it to say to the powers that be in Washington that unless you make a deal with us, you'll end up with these people who are much more radical than we are.
Here's what somebody like Bill McKibben would say, and I know you've had your debates with him. As dire as things are for the climate,
yeah,
it's not like the movement hasn't accomplished anything. Pipelines have been shut down peacefully.
Sure.
Legislation passed. Over 6 million people got involved with Greta Thunberg's climate strikes in 2019. How concerned are you that engaging with more militant tactics could backfire and damage the movement?
Of course it could. Of course it could. I mean, if people started doing really stupid things, as in killing people, you know, I don't know, assassinating CEOs or something like that, then certainly the backlash would be overwhelming. So that's why I think we need to continue to draw a very sharp line against that type of violence. And you're absolutely right that everything that the movement has accomplished so far has been on the basis of nonviolence, because that's the only strategy we have used. But our victories have been very local and very partial. We in the movement certainly haven't brought fossil fuel production to a stop as we have to.
Andreas, Ezra Klein, New York Times columnist, wrote a piece about your book and the financial fallout from pipeline sabotage potentially.
Yeah.
He writes this: the consequence of a wave of bombings to obliterate energy infrastructure would be to raise the price on energy immediately all across the world, and the burdens would fall heaviest on the poor. Is he wrong?
Yeah, so on the argument that there would be economic pain from property destruction, yeah, of course there is that risk. The problem here is, first of all, that any kind of phasing out of fossil fuel production and consumption will trigger price spikes. It's very difficult to see us getting rid of fossil fuels without them becoming more expensive. So advocating a strategy that doesn't make energy more expensive is almost tantamount, fossil energy more expensive is almost tantamount to not advocating mitigation at all. And of course, if you engage in property destruction that causes such disruption to prices, you run a risk of alienating people. But I think that if people go about this in a careful fashion, and if they time property destruction of this sort to moments when the impacts of the climate crisis are being felt, there would be a decent chance to also gain popular support for these kind of actions.
One of the things that would mitigate against that, unfortunately, is that we live in a world of Fox News. And if they were to see activists on the left going after private property in the name of climate change, I think you can write the script. The next thing you know, you'd have blaring headlines about eco-terrorism. So how do you avoid playing into the eco-terrorism narrative, or can you?
Yeah. Well, I don't think that we should adapt our tactics after the enemy's script. If the protesters after the murder of George Floyd would have done so, they certainly would have stayed home. Because, of course, what Fox told the viewers was that BLM was a terrorist Marxist movement. If you challenge vested interests, you will face that kind of backlash. Whether you challenge them peacefully or you challenge them through property destruction, you will certainly get demonization from the far right. That's already happening. But I do think that at some point, if there's any rationality in the human species left, then people in moments when they see their habitats, their ecosystems around them disappearing and their lives becoming unbearable, if in that moment you have climate activists who strike against the sources of all this pain and suffering, then at least some segments of the population should presumably support that. If not now, then maybe when it's 2 degrees or 3 degrees hotter. But the task for the climate movement isn't to wait until it's extremely late, which it already is, but to move ahead and to use opportunities of extreme climate disaster, which are raining upon us, to drive this point home to people. We can't have more fossil fuel infrastructure and a habitable planet at the same time. We need to choose one or the other.
Let's take sabotage off the table for a second.
Yes.
Is there a way that the movement could be smarter in the way that it engages in nonviolent protest?
Yes. I think nonviolent protest works best when it targets fossil fuel production. When you have nonviolent mass actions that close down traffic in general, squares in general, in cities, it's a kind of indiscriminate targeting of urban activity that isn't necessarily the best. I think it makes much more sense to have things like climate camps, where you have people peacefully breaking through police lines, shutting down gas pipelines or coal mines, that's usually the case in the German climate camps, shutting this infrastructure down, if only for a couple of days. That's a very effective way of getting people together in action and openly targeting the source of the problem.
Finally, we are coming up on major climate talks in Glasgow, and what John Kerry has described is the last best hope for international action on this. Are you feeling any hope about these talks, and what would be a good outcome from them?
To be honest, I have no hope about those talks. This is the 26th COP. I'm sure I'll be able to, if I live, join my kids to COP 52 down the road if things continue like this, because these COPs have produced nothing apart from complete business as usual. I do have some hope that the protests at Glasgow can reinvigorate the climate movement, because it's been in something like a coma after the pandemic broke out, and it hasn't regained the momentum from 2019.
Do you expect any acts of sabotage at Glasgow?
I don't expect any, but I would certainly hope for a more militant edge at the COP26 protests than what we've seen at any other COP protest so far. I mean, my faith in humanity would certainly be reinforced if there was real anger on the streets of Glasgow, given the state of this planet and what capital is doing to just worsen the situation all the time.
Andreas Malm, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Andreas Malm is an associate professor at Lund University in Sweden. His book is called How to Blow Up a Pipeline.